It's time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, co-owner and chief vet at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Here she is, Dr. Cannon.
Hello, Jill.
Hello. All right, are you ready?
I'm ready for wonderful questions today.
Are you prepared?
Absolutely.
It's always your answer. It's a wonderful thing. All right, Stacy in Armenia. Question for the vet. Hi, my cat is very fearful. I rescued her from a shelter where she hid under a blanket. It took months to earn her trust, and now she's a loving lap cat. She now needs to go to the vet. I know this will be traumatic for her. She won't let me practice putting her in the carrier. Is there a medication I can ask a vet to prescribe so this is not a horrific experience? Some sort of anti-anxiety like gabapentin? The calming treats don't work for her.
So this is a very common issue with cats who don't like to go in the car, they don't like to go in the carrier, they don't like things that are, you know, not of the usual. And so this is a great question. We handle this on a regular basis. One thing that can be done, instead of shoving her into the carrier, what my suggestion would be is to get a carrier that you can take the top off of. So the little screws, the screws take a long time to get them off, but the clips can be difficult because they make noise. So you can choose if you've got some of the clips that go on the sides that aren't super loud, or you don't put the top on with your kitty in there, then that's probably okay and quicker. So you take the top off of your carrier and leave that carrier right in a nice, safe place in the living room, maybe just next to the couch or next to a chair, and put a bed in there and see if your kitty will start to venture into that place. You could actually feed her in that carrier. That wouldn't be a bad idea. If you wanted to not do it in the living room, you could move it into the kitchen and feed her in the carrier. And this is the kind of thing that you want to develop over the span of about a month, getting her comfortable in that carrier. If she then chooses to go in there and feel safe, then putting the top on the carrier, leave it in the same spot, start feeding her in there with the top on it. And this is how we get them used to being in the carrier. That's number one. There is a product, a pheromone product called Feel-Away, which many of my clients already know about, but it is a pheromone. It's synthetic, but it mimics the pheromone that the mother secretes when the kittens are nursing, and so it's a calming pheromone. If you're going to spray that, you don't want to do it when the cat's in there. We like to spray, 10 or 15 minutes before you want them to go in, or you can spray it on a cloth and rub the inside of the carrier. That sometimes helps right from the get-go. You can spray a towel, too. I spray them outside, bring it in after about 5 minutes, fold it up and put it in the carrier. That's helpful. And when you get your kitty more comfortable in the carrier, if you have the time to do that, then we go also with the calming medication. It's a little bit more difficult for us to prescribe all of the medications until we see your cat, especially when they're coming from a shelter. We don't always have a veterinarian that you can turn to that you used to go to prescribe something. But gabapentin is a great idea, and 100 to 150 milligrams, depending on the cat's weight, is something that I will prescribe to a patient that I haven't seen yet. The trazodone, which we use at times as well, which is an anti-anxiety medication, probably would not prescribe that without first seeing your kitty. But gabapentin is quite safe, and it comes in a capsule, and it comes in a tablet, so you can actually use the capsule and just sprinkle the powder in food. We do it about 2 hours prior to the vet visit, and it really is helpful just to take the edge off. And then you go to a veterinarian who uses fear-free ideas. So, everyone in my practice has been trained in the fear-free program. And so we use treats. We have a quiet room as best as we can. We try to put kitties right in the room when they come in so they're not disturbed by dogs. We try to keep things quiet. We use a towel with Feel Away on the table. So, you know, let us know before you come that your cat's super fearful, and we will make all of those arrangements for you. And other practices that use the same ideas will do the same thing.
All right. And you answered my main question, which is the cat is like, okay, how do I give the gabapentin, having had a long series of cats who...
Right. So you can, it's nice because you can sprinkle it in food. So you want to be able to I'm hoping, have a, you know, a kitty who eats some kind of canned food. Most cats do. And if you need to, you might need to fast them, you know, the night before, just don't feed dinner. And then, you know, you're going to have a super hungry cat in the morning, 2 hours before your visit. Give a little bit of food, maybe a couple of tablespoons with the gabapentin mixed in, so you're sure that you're getting that ingestion.
You can't do more than that. You absolutely can't do more than that.
It's really super helpful. It's helpful for us and helpful for the cat. And, you know, keeping things quiet, using the towel when they're in the room, we keep them covered up with the towel, and I look at little sections at once, and it's amazing how they feel more comfortable.
Well, yeah, if you look at it from the cat's point of view,
right?
It's a whole other thing.
It's a big, scary world out there.
It's also, what are you people doing? I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
And if you start off in a shelter and you have the pleasure, basically, of not then going into a house and being happy in the house, then it's even more. What are you doing and why?
Yes, it's the fear, the anxiety, the stress that that we don't want to put them through when we're trying to do good things, right?
Exactly. And that's actually true for all two-legged and four-legged.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Marissa, in New Preston, I took my Dachshund Mix Digger to the vet to have one of his anal glands expressed. Vet said it was still bothering him in a couple weeks. Vet said if it was still bothering him in a couple weeks, I should come back and they'd put a catheter-type thing to get any remaining matter out. In the meantime, though, I read that manually expressing a dog's glands can make them lose the ability to express on their own. Do you have any opinions about that? I can see that the gland is still bothering Digger. I'm thinking that if that may be a warm compress, might be a compromise.
The anal glands are problematic in lots of dogs, mostly small dogs, but sometimes bigger dogs. This is a dachshund, so not uncommon to have anal gland problems. We call them glands, but they're actually little sacs that are lined with glandular cells that produce secretions. And normally in the wild, when dogs were developing and they, you know, dogs are directly from wolves, they served to mark territory. So they're vestigial scent glands, and they, when the stool passes, if you have a formed bowel movement, your dog has a formed bowel movement, the stool passes, it puts a little pressure on that sac, which squirts out a little bit of that material on the stool, and one way then for a dog to mark its territory. With our domestic dogs, especially since we've messed with their size and shape, and all of that, and their metabolisms, then we have some trouble, not uncommonly, with the anal glands. And so when they get full and they can't secrete, so they might not be able to secrete normally out of this little duct that comes out right at the anus, right at about, if the anus is a clock, right about 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock, there's a tiny little opening there, and the duct opens. The duct runs from there to the sac, and the material in the sac comes through the duct and gets on the feces. But this is a problem if that duct gets plugged up with dry stool. It's a problem if your dog has chronic loose stool and doesn't put any pressure on those glands. It's a problem if your dog is overweight and there's a big old fat pad there, and it kind of crimps off the duct when the stool passes, so they can't empty well. Sometimes it's a problem if their dogs are allergic, and they seem to, it irritates all the glands in the body, and they overproduce secretions. Sometimes the secretions are really, really dry and can't come out well. So lots of lots of potential problems with anal glands. And so this is a great question. I don't believe that manually expressing a dog's glands can make them lose the ability to express on their own. I think that that is incorrect information. If the glands are constantly inflamed, we need to come up with a reason for that potentially and do something to treat the underlying cause, for instance, weight loss, etc. You will see that a dog having a problem, they're the dogs who drag their bums all over the grass and sometimes the carpet in the house, or they're licking the anal area a lot, or you might just get that really strong, musky, smelly odor when the glands are overflowing.
You just gave musk a bad name.
Yeah, right. The odor is very, very strong, and it is something you don't forget once you smell it.
Quite specific. Can I interrupt for one? Can I interrupt for one quick second and just ask? I had the very first little Chien, who was a poodle, a runt miniature poodle. Not a
tiny,
toy.
A tiny dog?
She was pretty small. And, you know, she was, and this was like way back in the day when people were still, like knuckles were still dragging on the ground in terms of dog stuff. Anyway, you know, she would periodically scoot and then that would solve it. And that was, you know, and that was that. And then she would, I mean, again, I didn't know anything. But
yes.
The scooting seemed to, I guess what I'm trying to find out
her
is
her way of putting pressure, way of putting pressure on the glands. Absolutely.
And she did it, she dealt with it, and you know, and then she'd do it again, you know, not the next hour.
And that's not a dog, if it doesn't happen again for a month, you know, expressing those glands probably isn't necessary unless you're going to have company in it and you're going to
exactly.
get it. Exactly. Yeah, right? So, so I think what's going on with this little dachshund is that they're not easily expressed if the vet didn't think that they got everything out. It may be that there's some inflammation going on there. Sometimes they'll get infected, and I'll get a liquidy, bloody material out, in which case I do put a catheter up in that tiny duct.
Right.
When I can. I can probably do that with non-sedated dogs 90% of the time. There are some dogs that there's no way they're going to allow you to do that without sedation. Put a little catheter in there, and first I express all the material, put the catheter in, and then put in some antibiotic, usually have a little cortisone in it, ointment, and just leave it in. And then we check again in a week. So the warm compress is a good idea as well to try to bring blood supply to the area. It's not an area that has a great deal of blood supply. So if you've got inflammation and you bring blood supply there, it can help. If you have infection, it can help. It can help to maybe make the secretions a little more liquid so they're easier, so they come out a bit easier as well, theoretically.
All right. So this all sounds great. And I guess if I were just being me and answering the question, even though it was for you, because it's still bothering them, because Digger's already been expressed, because manually expressing a dog's glands don't damage the dog's ability to express themselves, and because it's still bugging him, would you just send him back for that one to get the catheter thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be really unlikely that the warm compress would solve the problem, but I think it's a good idea to warm compress for comfort, and also right before you go back to the vet, do some warm compresses for 5 or 10 minutes, and it might be easier for the veterinarian to then express everything out of the gland. And then you might need some anti-inflammatories to make Digger more comfortable.
Right. Got it. All right. I just think that if it's still there and it's bugging him and the instruction was given, it's not going to be solved just by the compresses.
Unlikely.
Right. Okay. Well, unlikely is clear. Gordon and Allie in New York City. We live with our corgi on the third floor of an apartment building. Maisie is 6 and a half, and at her last few checkups, the vet said she was fine. But lately, we've seen her back legs suddenly go out from under her when going up the stairs. It looks like they suddenly sharply bend at the knee joint, or whatever you call that joint in the hind leg. Then she gets up and keeps going like nothing's wrong. We don't know what to make of it since the vet said she was fine. What do you think?
I think going up, walking up to the third floor can be difficult if she's having problems. And sometimes we don't see issues when they're at the vet's. You know, we do our physical exam. We'll do full range of motion. Sometimes we don't watch them walk either. You know, sometimes going outside and watching. So maybe you want to do another visit. Have your doctor do a full, you know, do a better neurologic exam. Watch your dog walk outside and watch your dog go up and down the stairs. But it can be something that is, excuse me, as simple as arthritis, even at 6 and a half. Osteoarthritis of knees or hips. We can also see problems with weakness, with intervertebral disc disease, what people call a slipped disc, a little bit of disc material. Usually that's a little bit less likely. It is a common problem, a not uncommon problem in corgis, but it's a little bit less likely because usually those dogs are quite painful and you're not mentioning anything about pain here. You can also get stenosis or narrowing of the spinal column at the lumbosacral area, right where the last lumbar vertebrae connects to the sacrum. Causing some compression on the spinal cord, causing those kinds of symptoms. And the last thing that comes to mind is is called degenerative myelopathy, or DM. And the average age of onset is usually later than 6 and a half, but not always. But usually it's more like 10 or 11 years of age. And you get a gradual degeneration of the white matter in the spinal cord, which is similar to ALS in people. And there are, of the Pembroke Welsh Corgis, which are the most common corgi that I see, somewhere around 25 to 30% of them can carry the gene for DM. So they have to carry both of the mutated genes in order to actually express in degenerative myelopathy. But it is something that can be tested for as far as the gene mutation. Doesn't mean, though, that they actually have it. So they could actually have both genes and not ever have DM. So it is somewhat confusing, but it is more of the diagnosis is more on a clinical basis. So you might want to consider, if your veterinarian checks up on your dog, doesn't find anything, does x-rays, everything looks fine, consider a visit with a veterinary neurologist. Because if you catch this earlier, you can start earlier intervention, which is, it's not great intervention, but particular exercise therapy that you could learn from a canine rehabilitation specialist.
That's exactly.
And there's some other things that we can do.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Is it something that can be chiropracted or acupunctured or
acupuncture potentially,
exercise.
But it is even difficult. You know, it's a difficult diagnosis with acupuncture. So absolutely, you can trial acupuncture, but also the physical exercise is really important to delay the onset.
Right.
Vitamin supplements, B, C, and E, too, sometimes NAC, which is N-acetylcysteine. So there are things that can be done, and you don't want to wait until it's progressed. So don't want to scare you with this idea, but it's something to think about and be on top of. It's possible we may have some arthritis in the knees that's causing it. So x-rays to start with, absolutely.
So to the vet to start with, and then take it from there. And that's just, I'm going to once again interject as a civilian. How many times have you... I'm going to ask you, how many times have you ever taken a kid home from the doctor and the kid gets sick? Yeah, you know, it's like everything is fine and then something, or the dog back from the vet and then something happens. You know, it's not unheard of. And
right,
as
right.
You
and especially when symptoms are, you know, are early on and then they have this adrenaline rush going into the vet office and they seem absolutely fine. You know, nothing, there's no lameness anymore, there's no weakness, all of that. So it's something to continue to pursue. I think this is a great question.
All right, so time flies when you're having fun, and we have two more minutes, basically. So how are you on hamster UTIs?
I could comment.
All right. I'm jumping ahead. Terry and Jim in New Paltz. Our son's hamster just recovered from a UTI with the help of a vet. Is there anything we can do as far as food, water, bedding, et cetera, no, just one et cetera, which is correct, to try to prevent it from happening again?
Yes. Clean are the words. So the bedding, you know, the bedding has to be sort of fresh smelling and really clean, and it's got to be changed more often. You've got to keep stress low in these hamsters. Some hamsters are stressed by having lots of kids handling them. Now, many of them are used to that, and it's no problem. But sometimes they get a little too stressed with too much handling, and then that water bottle is a problem chronically. It has to be really cleaned and, even sterilized, maybe go through the dishwasher, put really hot water in it, and then rinse it really well. It's got to be done on a regular basis so that you're not spreading bacteria. So, you know, we want to be careful about bacteria coming from both ends, from ingestion and from the back end, from the bedding. You know, if they're going to be sitting in wet bedding, not a good thing at all. So that's my advice.
All right.
Not being a hamster expert.
But you had them. We all had them, right?
Yes.
I just couldn't. I couldn't.
Right. I just didn't know anything about veterinary medicine when I had them.
But it's
common sense most of the time.
And just how often would you change? One of the reasons that I didn't have them is because it never seemed – when I say sanitary, what I mean is I would be inclined to change a cage three times. How often?
That depends on how many hamsters you have. So if you have a single, many people have a pair, then a couple times a week. You know, you can't leave that bedding minimally once a week. But if you've got an older hamster that might have some kidney troubles and is drinking a ton of water and urinating a lot, then you need to get rid of that bedding, you know, more quickly, every other day. It depends.
And one last,
just like everything.
Exactly. And one last question: Can you? I mean, is there? Do you have to dump out the whole thing, clean out the whole cage, or can you pull out? Is there like clumping?
No, I think you're better off putting less in. You can put cardboard in there, little cardboard tubes in there for hiding. Put less bedding in with newspaper underneath, and clean the whole thing. Dump the whole thing. Clean the cage.
Got it. Okay. That's. I wish I had framed that question a little more intelligently, but that's what I was going for. And we have done this in, you know, after the two-minute warning, so thank you very much, Dr. Cannon. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.